Incredible.
There has been a decided shift in my conduct.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, it was torn off of me. Really? There's a certain point where I wasn't permitted to keep being crazy.
Yeah, that's nice. Mm-hmm.
It really has been.
Yes.
I wish it on everybody.
That's very kind, yes.
Yeah. And it was, it happened, it was given to me by the client that I was closest to for 38 years.
Uh-huh.
You know, he fired me.
Yeah, good move.
Well, I'm really grateful to him.
Yeah.
There is, you know, the thing after the thing after the thing is a mm-hmm. momentum
mm-hmm.
that has its own life once you start a building project.
Yeah, of course, right, yeah.
Yeah, and it runs all the players in it. It just asks for what comes next all the time.
Right.
And he's kind of bent up and crippled. He had about two or three operations on his back. He can't stand up very well. And he's so he can't take an active part in his life.
I see, right.
So he gave all the power to his wife.
I hope that was a wise decision.
Well, that's questionable. And she has an idea about being intimately involved with every action and decision on the alteration we're making, going to make to their house.
Oh, that sounds like bad news.
Yeah, it's totally bad news. And then you can't operate within a fixed price with the client so immersed in the process.
No, because they just keep running the clock. They run their mouth and they run the clock.
Ah, and they distract everybody.
Yeah, everything. That's right.
So it was a gift to finally get thrown off the guy.
Fantastic.
And I took a wonderful hit as being I think he sounded like Jeffrey Lurie. I don't know. That I lack emotional intelligence.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I thought that was great.
Yeah.
Wonderful justification.
It's nice to be accused of something at least once a day.
Yeah.
I mean, without some kind of indignation, I imagine I would just float away.
Yes, right. It helps hold you down.
Yeah, I used to avoid, you know, confrontation and accusation. Now it's like, please accuse me of something. even if it's emotional incompetence.
I mean, what difference does it all make?
Yeah, really, what difference does it make?
Really? give her the job. See, we'll see what happens.
Exactly.
See what human being you're going to find that can put up with her obsessiveness.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. The rules, one of the rules is you couldn't drive up the driveway to the parking area only in certain hours of the day.
Oh, sure, that's going to work.
It's nice. Yes, in other words, you got to do this huge construction project without interfering with their life at all. The tranquility and peacefulness of their existence should not at all be problems to mess with.
It sounds like they should just cancel the construction project.
Well, I'll say one last sentence about it.
Okay.
They actually have 5 bedrooms in the house.
We should all move in. Maybe they want to start an ashram.
Right. And they and their 2 daughters, who are around 12
mm-hmm.
and 8, have been living in the master bedroom. The girls were in the gym. They turned that into a nest. And they're not, none of the other bedrooms qualify for them to be in there.
Oh.
Because they don't, they're not structured so that they can have the idea that she has about how to live relating to the daughters as they grow up.
Hmm. Oh.
So the idea was to raise the roof on this barn 6 feet and create a full second story room up there where you can put 2 bathrooms and 2 bedrooms.
I see.
Yeah, a very complicated process.
Very complicated, yeah.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I know what happens when I try to raise the roof. It's one karma field after another.
It is.
If you're a human, if you're a person, if you are operating in a space, if you have some sense of hegemony and control, then it's just one drama field after another, and it takes a lifetime, if not a dozen, to figure out that that just really sucks.
Nothing banging into nothing.
Yeah.
And looking like something.
That is that's the seeker's principal dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Any new videos, Suzanne? Something to spice up our spiritual life?
Trying to remember though. Nothing coming to mind.
Are we still in love with Naho, or is she?
There's not a lot of her.
Last week's fad.
Well, I like the ones where she talks to the camera more than the.
Yeah.
So I haven't. She doesn't really have a lot on there. I didn't feel like listening to the long talks, like in Prague or wherever she.
Are those are not as satisfying?
I just like those little hypnotic little short ones she does. I can mm-hmm. only take so much of that, and then it's sort of like, that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, LMA had a couple things up on Facebook, but I looked at a little of them, but...
Right.
And let me think.
Why did it become too much?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm partly being dramatic, you know, but...
No, but I agree with you. I just heard that and said, yeah, I agree with you. Why do we agree that it's too much?
Well, I got to come back to Earth and function, I guess. How about you? How come it's too much for you?
Well, it begins to look like something, and it's making something out of nothing. This is nothing inherently to begin with. No matter what she has to say about it. How much can you say about it?
Not really.
Lots. Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I get the sense that there really isn't anything to do.
That's the problem. I mean, I got a lot of time on my hands. I wish I had something to do.
Well, Well, in the dignity of nothingness.
Pick up an instrument.
Yeah, I could do that. I didn't get out of jury duty, but I guess Bill Cosby was down in Orangetown today, so I missed him by 2 days.
Oh. Have you already reported, or are you about
to? No, I have to go Thursday, but supposedly he had a hearing down there today.
So. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. I tried to get out of there, but they said, nah.
Well, now you have something to do.
Yeah. I don't mind going for the day. I just don't want to go back.
We'll see. You might end up on a 6-month-long murder trial.
Yeah. I hope not.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about that today, like, if you listen to Peter Brown, you're like, what does it even matter, you know?
Well, he's only good at the doctor's office for like 2 or 3 hours. You know, I mean, after that, he starts to run batshit.
It's just like a kangaroo court anyway, you know, so. Since nothing's happening and, you know, how do you really take anything seriously?
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I guess you do when you do and you don't when you don't. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Wind Free?
No.
Well, he has a call-in program, and somebody gets
cool.
on the call, and the caller enters, supposedly feel something or pick up something from the call. Search that one.
That sounds like fun.
They tape the talks so you can listen to them at any time.
So it's like a channeling thing?
Yeah. He's the guy that wrote the biography of Edgar Cayce in collaboration with David Wilcock.
I see. Right.
He identified Wilcox as the second coming of
Edgar Cayce?
Edgar Cayce, yeah.
Okay.
I haven't read the book.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's been on a kind of a what is that, the Miracle of One or the David channeled some tome. And it forms the basis of their grasp. What the hell's the name of it? Anyway, you see how it's stuck with me.
Yeah.
It's too airy fairy.
It's airy fairy?
Yeah. It's all so important.
We're very impressionable.
Indeed.
And we don't have any actual idea what's going on or how it's going on or why or the wherefore or whether it has purpose or meaning or not.
Provides solace.
Yeah, so a lot of these journeys are like that. They provide a context for meaning and association and belonging and solace of some kind. that anything to avoid at all cost fundamental liberated relationship with living, which is I don't know what's happening. Yeah.
It's a magic show. At least I get glimpses of it, it seems, when the grasp of the need to be driven to do something.
Right.
Is either released or the rope goes slack. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Be nice to have like a TV show where people just kind of wander on and off set and hang out in slack. And everything becomes such a soundbite. Mm-hmm. Just like we mimic the rhythm and the pace of TV programs. As you know, indications of how life should look or life should run or how it would be relevant. Mm. And of course, in broadcast media, there's no room for slack. You know, Oprah never said, "Hey, why don't we take the next 15 seconds and just do nothing and say nothing?" You know.
That's especially true in radio.
Yeah, when it's voice only, that's right.
Yeah, dead space is like, uh-oh, what happened?
Yeah. Yep. I think that's, that's why, rudimentary meditation and mindfulness practices are so useful in a sense that you're forced to participate in, slack. Mm-hmm. You because our restlessness is so so systemic, sitting down in stillness and quietude without distraction is, that's just absolute death to most people. It's intolerable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My observation is that the more money you have, the faster you go.
The faster you go?
Yes. Because you can afford to pay for more distractions. Mm. How many people, what do you need 3 or 4 houses for? Then you're obliged to travel all the time from one to another.
Mm-hmm. Well, because they each have a different entertainment center, I guess.
Yes.
I mean, what's available from popular culture in terms of consumption of entertainment and distraction is, for the most part, so dull and so banal. Mm-hmm. We fill ourselves up with shallow attempts at artistry or self-expression and the consumption of, music and video and movies and all these things. And the number of them that are actually provocative or nourishing or spiritually or emotionally fulfilling tends to be, very few and far between. Mm.
I did have a dream that I met Eckhart Tolle. That was weird.
Oh, fun.
He was serving breakfast at a hotel. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. What did you order from him?
Well, I wanted to ask him a question. He seemed open to it, but he was also kind of busy bringing out coffee.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I don't know why he was doing that.
It must be hard to be a guru when you're working the day shift. I'd really like to get back to you on that, but I got three tables. And the toast is up. Gotta run.
But then Amy Schumer came out and I started talking to her. And so he got upstaged by Amy Schumer.
Okay.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Amy Schumer would be happy to hear that you sought spiritual succor from her instead of Eckhart Tolle.
Especially because she's taking a lot of flack for stealing other people's jokes right now.
Yeah, what's going on with that?
I guess there's a lot of jokes that some comedians are saying are theirs, their jokes.
Oh.
That she's made. But, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, things kind of are out there. And you can see how that could happen, you know?
She could just be channeling jokes from the ether and...
Yeah, exactly.
Not even do it intentionally or consciously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel so blah. I don't even have any questions or comments or anything.
Well, blah's not bad. Blah's a good, it's a good leaping off point.
Yeah, how so?
Well, if you're mind and your rhythm is at some degree of rest, which may look like boredom or blah or, you know, disinterest, you're in a real sweet spot.
Doesn't really feel very sweet.
Yes, I know. That's why you could say how it self-obscures, because it makes it look like you're surrounded by artifacts and objects that are familiar to you, or moods and textures in your own experience that are somehow familiar to you. So there seems to be no novelty, right? We are kind of seduced behind a wall of presumption or familiarity, and as we all know, familiarity breeds contempt. So the blah is really a sweet spot. It's because it's a membrane. It's a portal where it looks like familiarity might be breeding contempt, or at least, you know, lack of novelty, lack of interest. But look again. Feel again. See if it's true that you're really surrounded by familiar objects or familiar moods, familiar thoughts or familiar feelings. Maybe right in the midst of the blah, there's something really uncanny going on.
You can almost guarantee it.
Yeah, you pretty much can guarantee it. That's right.
It's never idle.
Right. So we become, easily monotone. Because we're not peeling away the familiar presentation of what it is we imagine we're experiencing or how we're experiencing. But what's actually appearing in the space of experiencing. That's where the fascination lies. Not necessarily with the objects, but objects can reflect back to you. It can reveal back to you something that's poignant and playful and charming and seductive and, lustful and crazy and big, which is your own attention, the nature and texture of your own attention. So that's the, and if we're distracted, if we're too busy, if we're too taken up with things, then it makes it very difficult to repossess ourselves. So this is kind of like a repo man thing. Repossess yourself. Maybe block can also be felt as, relaxation, as quietude. It's just as rest, availability. And so the feeling that is you, the feeling tone that is you, is remarkable. Animated. Curious and creative without having to be entertained by objects. I mean, wouldn't that be fun if your own attention, if your own awareness were so in love with itself, not through, sentimentality or, demonstrative behavior, but just... that there is attention, that there is awareness, that there is sensitivity at all, that there is consciousness at all, becomes, you could say, fond and interested and curious about itself without having to rely on entertainment or objects or busyness or plans, right, opinions, for it to feel a rich quiescence, a rich... rich narrative of silence. And blah's a great, great place for that to launch. Or remain blah. Which is like, that's cool too. It's funny. It's like through... We can't help from being like spontaneously and aggressively preferential. Mm-hmm. The mind that compares, that imagines it knows what's happening, why, when, how, where, what the outcome is, that it's blah or whatever it is part of this habit of comparison and staking a claim in present experience. The exhausting restlessness of mind that deals in objects. So blah could be a great point where you can discover something strange and playful, impish, about consciousness itself. so that this experiencing became the both the place that we're looking from and the texture that we're looking at. Looking from and looking at the same, right? The same core texture of experiencing, looking from and looking at. Without it or without that having to be pleasing to us somehow. I would imagine that as this, you know, becomes more playful with itself, it's no longer operating through the common habit of things being pleasing to me or entertaining. It's a different, right, echelon, can we say, of subtlety and nourishment, which ain't human, and is not interested in operating through the currency, the typical currency of human, which is objects and preference. Sentiment and sensuality. Mm-hmm. So if I'm unhappy with the objects, if I'm, you know, wishy-washy with respect to my preferences, if the things that I normally seek stimulation or entertainment from aren't providing it, that's great. Now you've got this present field to play with, to explore from a completely, you know, new and novel vantage point.
Moving through walls is next.
Yeah, that's right. Moving through walls. Why not? You know, the men who stare at goats.
What you're describing is the collapse of the conviction of the illusion.
Yes, sure. That's another great metaphor, the collapse of presumption, the collapse of conviction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. You know, the cessation of... the cessation of how we feel about anything. We think that, you know, everything goes dull or becomes, you know, unimaginative if we're no longer interested in how we think or feel about it. Which is, you know, that's the currency of human interactivity, the currency of objects, the currency of preferences and outcomes. Some form of, you know, ongoing stimulation, titillation of some kind. And if that, if that habit, breaks down or becomes quiescent.
Then what do you have?
That's right.
What's there then?
Yeah. And sure. Exactly. What's there then? What's here now? And we could appreciate how a very common response to that question could be something we would call blah. You know, without a question, without an imperative, without a vector of some kind. Yeah, I think blah can transmute rather easily into you know, a deep liberation.
Sounds like Don Juan's teaching.
I'm working on it.
What did she say?
She's working on it.
What did you say? Oh, she's working on it.
We're capable of really remarkable realms or iterations of intimacy and, you know, serenity, realms or harmonics of feeling tone that, you know, the conformist culture doesn't celebrate. So instead, you know, we're very base, you know, our intimacy is through conversation or persuasion or manipulation or some kind of, you know, sexual tension or consummation or whatever, you know, the human emotion is. And those are all lovely, of course, you know, when they're going your way and even when they're not, but we're really playing around with a different level or a different quality of intimacy, you know, kind of like, what is it when you can move objects at a distance or something with your mind? What's that called?
Oh, kinesis?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we're doing. We're playing around with the textures of, call it telekinesis, where just being, you know, together with ourselves or with each other, and then that being kind of stereophonic. I mean, you're both with yourself and with so-called others, you know, at whatever the same time means. So there's this opportunity for a very playful telekinesis. Incredible harmonic of feeling and unpredictability and playfulness. Which is extraordinarily nourishing. It's quite delightful. We don't make a lot of room for it in, you know, our busy lives, because it's kind of like the rules by which we agree to play when it comes to intimacy or this kind of harmonic of telekinesis are supposed to be between, you know, I don't know, parent and a child, siblings, lovers, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. But we can enter into realms of exquisite intimacy that are, I would say, respectful and honoring and not non-manipulative. That the common culture doesn't really have any language for.
And it won't result in you getting on some sort of list or something.
That's right. And won't result on you having to wear a scarlet A.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or getting on a list. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, something that, you know, something that tickles the heart or tickles our sensibility and sensitivity, tickles our deep appreciation for novelty, and which is unspoken. Because it's all feeling tone. No, and there's a deep love there. There's a deep affection. Everyone's, you know, everyone's face and everyone's eyes and everyone's voice and everyone's smirks and is just, oh, you know, it's a grandeur of you know, it's you know, it's the Fibonacci geometry, you know, of the human face, the human smile. You're like, whoa, I mean, you're just overwhelmed in a sea of sacred geometry. You know, animate sacred geometry operating through, you know, what we call, you know, flesh tones. Wow, that's really going on. And that's not an isolated, right? It's not an isolated place. I mean, you can only inhabit your own experience, that's for sure. But the harmonic of feeling this is, you know, very open, very affectionate. Incredibly nourishing, far from blah, but, you know, blah's great too. I think, you know, I think we're taught, it's like we're taught that it's not okay to fall in love with each other. You know, like we're permitted or encouraged to fall in love, but we're like permitted or encouraged to fall in love, like through the flesh, you know, or through a legal union. We're not, no one said, hey, by the way, it's really, really cool to just fall in love with each other, fall in love with everything as, you know, nuanced, radiant presence, which doesn't have to be, you know, consummated by manipulation or, you know, stuff like that. It's light. It's easy come. It's easy go. It takes no prisoners. Yeah. I think it's a very interesting challenge to get in touch with profundity of our capacity for affection, which has been, you know, tamped down and made sinful even by so much, you know, religious and spiritual culture because of the fear of, I don't know, physical intimacy or intercourse or, you know, some kind of, I forget the word when you're playing around with too many people. What's that called?
Polyamorous?
Yeah, that kind.
An orgy?
Yeah, something less dramatic than that, yeah. Yeah, that. It's like the taboo, right? The taboo is that our capacity for incredible intimacy, true love, true interest, true connection, you know, telekinetic harmonic, is tamped down because, you know, of the, let's say the exaggerated emphasis on, you know, on physicality, or that sexual consummation is the ultimate way for humans to be intimate with each other. And wow, maybe it's not. Maybe there is a whole order of magnitude of ultimate ways to be intimate with oneself and with others through radiant vulnerability and radiant affection that has really no interest at all in, you know, consummating huffles and gruffles of the flesh. I mean, why would Buddhist or Hindu or whatever cultures, repress? I think because, like, you know, I mean, Hindu temples have, you know, fornicating things all over the place, right? Some of them.
Right. Chakra pujas.
Yeah, chakra pujas. Yeah, fornicating humans all over the place and all kinds of interesting, you know, geometric patterns. And that's one way. But we're speaking about an intimacy that's, you could say, very difficult to sculpt or to render, you know, through painting. Yeah. we don't have, or let's say it's challenging to find a vocabulary to talk about an openness of novelty and nourishment, which is, you know, the best love you could find, without it having to become codependent, without it enmeshed, rescuing, physical, you know, all that stuff that gets us in a lot of trouble. But the repression of that same word I'm looking for, the repression of sexual, it's not quite, why can't I think of this word? It's not polyamory or polygamy. What's the word that suggests that you interact with partners, many partners? Something, there's a metaphor in there somewhere. Whatever it is, that impulse is what's, repressed. I mean, the dolphins seem to deal with it without any trouble. You know, I mean, they're bisexual and multisexual and, let's eat fish and just twirl around with each other, all day and all night, blow bubbles and yahoo. So they don't, they're very, relaxed that way. But we tend to be, either overindulgent or repressive. Mm-hmm. And you could say both of those are shallow or mistaken. They miss the mark. They're mistaken frustrations for a capacity of delight that we have. A telekinetic harmonic of affection, which really releases us. And I think that feeling of availability and vulnerability is what occurs, you could say, when we use alcohol or when we use, marijuana or mushrooms or, ayahuasca to varying degrees. Yeah. I mean, Terence McKenna, would say, hey, if all of these primates were strolling around eating mushrooms and becoming, more acute in terms of their sensitivity and stuff, and then fornicating up a storm, that's good for the species. And he'd be right. We're speaking about a quality of intimacy that doesn't have to become or doesn't have to be consummated with, replication, acts of replication, We're just, feeling this. It's wild shit. And it doesn't have to be isolating, or isolated. That's where mindfulness should go. That's where meditation should go. Into these profound levels of intimacy that we're capable of on an interactive, basis. Rather than sitting in the meditation hall with 100-some-odd people, but, on your cushion with your eyes closed or open, doing your so-called mindfulness practice, kind of, commensurately with others, but there's no actual, there's no actual relationship.
That sounds like waking down, though.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go there. Wouldn't want to go there.
Maybe that's too penetrative with the eyes or something.
I think so. I think again, it's, having a moment of, being with someone's eyes is like, woo, wow, what fun, how delicious. But that it would become, forced.
Yeah.
It would become, a fetish of gazing.
Ritualized or something, right?
Yeah, ritualized as a fetish of gazing, it's not organic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, the waking down stuff, that I'd been to, at least, you know, I didn't sense or feel the level of intimacy that we're kind of, you know, playing around with conversationally and experientially now. It was kind of like you do some eye gazing and then you, you know, you do therapy. Right?
I only went to one, but that's about, that sums it up pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, I don't think, I don't know. I didn't attend enough of those events or participate to see what some of those waking down teachers might be capable of, but I certainly wasn't attracted to the presentation of Samuel Bonder and his lovely wife, you know, with respect to demonstrating a vocabulary and a mood of depthful sensitivity that, you know, would draw me in. It's just...
You went there when those two were there?
No, I think I saw a Bat Gap interview with the two of them.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ye gads. How frightening.
I went to one, a local one, I guess, with...
Mm-hmm.
Alan, I think his name was.
Right.
But he had kind of a sweetness to him.
Yeah, he was Lurch-like.
Kind of a vulnerability to him that was kind of likable, I thought.
Yeah. Yes.
There's a process in the what's called the advanced course in the Landmark Enterprise.
Uh-huh.
Where about, you know, just 70, 80 people, and you make two circles. And so they rotate against each other, so you always have a new partner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gazing exercise.
It's right.
Like you're silent and you're... See if you can sustain looking at the other person's eyes and
yeah.
What you get from it.
Hmm.
It has an impact.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did it at a Jack Kornfield thing once. Too. And then he made a comment like his wife's an introvert and every time he leaves that exercise she usually finds an excuse to leave or something like that. So
I've slept with Jack's wife. He's right. Sorry.
Which was kind of relieving. I thought, yeah, you know what? I don't blame her. This is awkward.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's painful and frightening to see beauty and to be beautiful.
Yeah.
you could say that's the fundamental shock for the whole species. It's too scary to see beauty and to feel beautiful. So we figured out how to compensate to get away from that as far as possible.
And then there was another one where we had to like listen to somebody's breathing, and when they breathed out, I think either you or they had to go ah or something like that.
That's nice.
Awkward.
Really? Any form of exposure is totally awkward.
It is. What are you going to do?
I don't know.
Keep doing it, but.
Yeah.
Just kind of go, it's showtime and do it.
That's right. It's showtime. This will be over soon. I got snacks back at the dorm. I can do this.
There's plenty of awkward moments in a psychotherapy session, so I've kind of gotten used to them by now. So.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. It's just one awkward moment after another.
No relief.
That's why we like TV so much.
Yeah. Cringe humor.
Yeah.
Although maybe the root word for awkward is awe.
Carl Renz would have fun with it, I'm sure.
Would he?
Yeah. I would suggest that the right amount or the right quality of beauty becomes satiating, and then that transmutes further into non-clinging, and non-clinging, you know, as a gateway to what's next, which is, you could say, the cessation of arising. So it's like intimacy or the present moment is always the bridge for being sated by beauty. And we grow even more naturally quiet and non-clinging. And we rest in cessation, non-arising. Nothing is familiar, but it's not unfamiliar. We're you could say, available or on the lookout for, you know, texture and communication from all sense windows and everything that's appearing in those sense windows is you know, singing a song, being felt. It doesn't have to trigger us into relationship or trigger us into action or trigger us into an opinion of some kind. To be consciously nourished by cessation, non-arising of self.
Oh, that's a wild statement.
That's our homecoming, isn't it? That's our gift. That's the blessing. That's the benediction. Mm-hmm. What an incredible gift. You know, so many people are wrestling with their anger and their anger about their anger and their forgiveness about their anger about their anger about their forgiveness and their, you know, the loop of self, the maddening loop of self has got us so twisted in knots. We imagine ourselves to be the product of an actual arising, circumstances and events and regrets and memory and becoming and insecurity and, oh my, lions and tigers and bears. And none of that is, it's not real. It's not reconcilable. I dare say it's not even healable. I mean, how many people are making, you know, money and careers out of healing mirage? Yeah, there's one right there. Like I said, it's just one awkward moment after another. I guess blahs become giddy. From blah to giddy.
That's right. Doesn't take much.
Really. Now I'm just happy about the silliest things.
My career. Yay.
Yay. It's more fun, I think, to be an adventurer than, you know, to end up in a state that someone would call enlightened or something like that. You know, it's like we're trying to trade off this never-ending stream of awkward moments for some kind of static condition or static idea that we might call, you know, enlightenment or liberation or something silly. It's like, you know, oh, so bada boom, you get a thing and, you know, now you eat Cheerios with aplomb. I mean, I don't know what's supposed to happen next, right? I mean, the thrill of feeling this is just, you could say, the nourishment of the adventuresomeness. It's an adventure. It's fun to feel and to look and to, you know, giggle and be quiet and to have an encounter with non-arising and then waft into some other, you know, kind of one-liner. I mean, that's, you know, if we're looking for a static condition where somehow the whole world is made right forever and you can, may as well just drop dead. What, I mean, you know, what? Is that what everybody wants? They want enlightenment to be equated with, oh, dropping dead? I'm not sure. What if it were just, you know, the capacity for a curious kind of fun, a curious kind of intimacy that was punctuated and visited upon by wonder, sensitivity, and a creativity that doesn't need a brush. Because your nature is creative. Your nature is really happy to be intimate and then scuttle away and then come back and scuttle away and be awkward and be sanguine and be beautiful and be shy and then, you know, waft off into some unspeakable grandeur. And that we could, you know, play around with it as a kind of an adventure together, whatever that implies or suggests. Just like, wow, what fun. Just feeling it. It's real. Feel it. Otherwise, you know, so many so-called enlightenment lectures, you know, is like someone that is enlightened, or let's say they are, or they say they are, and why should we disbelieve them? We just paid a lot of money to go see them. And now they're doling out what? You know, what, biographical shit or instructions or how to not suffer and all this stuff? And you're like, oh, my God, it's dull. And everyone's like, oh, I got something. I didn't get something. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to get. I didn't get enlightened. I'll go back to the next retreat. I hope I win the fucking lottery. You know, in the meantime, I'll do a little work and a little mindfulness. You know, it's like, wait, time out. We really have to, just for fun, rethink the entire geometry of what it is to be together and to feel this without it being destination oriented or becoming dead. There is nothing to find. There's no resting place, you know, no finality anyway. There's just this. It's just this improvisational movement, this luscious improvisational movement. The way that you feel, the way that you feel that you feel, that you think that you feel. How strange. This is like, you know, it's like going to the kiva. Going to the kiva, you know, before everyone retires for bed. And just playing around in a kind of an improvisational poetic space. That's fun. You know, this is like, you know, lighting a fire and hanging out with a warm blanket and just chilling in a poetic space without having to answer anything or figure anything out or become anything. Or gossip, of course, is always good. This way it's something that is, what would you say, present in your life, right? It's just present. It's present in your life. This is present in your life. The willingness and the, you know, good, the willingness and the good fortune of good company. To sit around the fire, hang out in the kiva, feel the rhythms of poetic space, you know, intimacy and beauty. And just ride it, right? Rather than anticipating or insisting on some kind of static condition, the greatest gift we could give ourselves is the ability just to ride the nourishing wave of poetic improvisation and not have to insist upon or demand some kind of finality to it or some kind of destination. That's our unspoken affection. Kiva time. You know, that's what we do. It's not like anyone's learned anything by hanging out and, you know, whatever the night sky sangha is. It's not like there's anything to learn. Shit. I mean, it's just gibberish. Fucking gibberish. but it is, it does become, you know, through, let's say, frequent participation, it truly becomes a kiva space. And that's nourishing, that is uplifting, that is enthralling, that's intimate, that's revelatory. What fun. That's, you know, that's a way to combat isolation or a way to combat becoming too self-consumed or too self-important or to suffer from compensatory, you know, behavioral impulses as a way of medicating or mitigating, you know, a fractured sense of being. It's fun to rethink it. You know, what is self-realization? What is it supposed to look like or feel like? How do you speak if you're on its tail or it's on your tail? You know, if you're participating in a coven or a kiva of poetic improvisation, rather than waiting around for an event, you're actually, wow, you're surfing liberation. It's just my way of talking us out of blah, I guess.
Doing a good job.
It's working, right? It's working.
Yeah, working.
Yeah.
It just sounds like you're saying what's so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's not like trying to create some kind of artificial hypnotic spell or anything. It's just cruising, you know, with this gift. Just cruising. Like, wow, this is sweet. Nice. And this is in our lives, not, you know, not something that's intermittent or artificial or waiting around for a retreat. Right? This is here. This is here. It's you. You make it happen by participating in it, by lending, you know, your Fibonacci sequence to the particle accelerator. Wow. That's kind of fun. And as we nourish ourselves and each other through that feeling, through the, you know, the poetry of the kiva, then, you know, you just naturally become more capable of sharing that with others. You know, creating that, you could say, vibration, that invitation with, you know, other people in whatever way that occurs. Because you have invited it into your life and you have participated in its theatrical creation and you know how it feels and you're imbued with the wisdom of it. You're imbued with the wisdom of it, and so you're not afraid of your own, you know, beatitude, and you're not afraid to explore that with, you know, someone else. Yeah. That would be a nice, right, fractal harmonic of the maturation of the species. Because this togetherness, you know, transcends belief. It transcends superstition, transcends, you know, gender and class. I would say that's how the, you know, if the species had just enough time left to reconsider its fate, that, you know, circles of intimacy, circles of liberation would, well, they would blossom. Maybe I'm dreaming too much. I don't know.
Well, this, it is there. How do you get to the point to be able to leave everything outside the door and enter into the circle?
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's right. That's right. Yeah. How do you do that? Nobody really knows. I think it's just through part miracle, part gift, part good fortune. Right? We learn how. I mean, we learn how. It's like the parents teach the children. The elders teach the young how to do that. So in the beginning, maybe it's a little awkward and strange, and we're not sure what the feeling tone is, and we're still struggling with the the remnant artifacts of conformist reality. But as we, you know, participate in it and participate again and participate again, there's a harmonic that shows us, teaches us, demonstrates to us how it feels to, you know, enter into a poetic space. And we learn anything, you know, like you learn how to play baseball, or you learn how to not punch your sister, you know, or you learn how to share, right? You learn how to tell the truth or not tell the truth according to your, you know, according to your need. we also learn through association and repetition and availability how to enter into poetic space. You know, that's, I would hope that's what, you know, these retreats are for, you know, these yogas and meditation groups are for. I would hope that's what, you know, there's enough intelligence to enter into, you know, poetic space with ahimsa, non-harming. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ah. Goes nice with tea, goes nice with scotch. It's a salon, I think, liberation salon style. Mm. Yeah. Well, shit, if there's nothing to be liberated from, then, you know, there's no one to be liberated and there's nothing to be liberated from. There's just this delight in participating in, you know, improvisational appearance, improvisational experience. Peppered with, you know, enough space so that one can actually feel what it's like to be free from arising. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a big event, big cathartic event. You know, just a little pinch here, a little pinch there. You know, you dip your toe in the water, you get accustomed to it. You feel how it feels to feel yourself without arising. Wow.